Persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. Stand by. The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your mind.
Hello, I'm Dr. Jerry Scheidbach, pastor of the Lighthouse Baptist Church in Santa Maria, California, and your brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage. Oh yeah, Jerusalem is officially acknowledged as the capital of Israel. Some background, ancient and modern, will frame the event nicely for us. The left weaponizing the Department of Justice, turning government into a political weapon. The communist playbook. Now, this could be the lowest form of treason, a betrayal of one of the founding principles of our republic. Mueller, Comey, Rosenstein, Obama, Hillary, all co-conspirators in this treason. Where's Session? Trump is Reagan without the tuxedo. He's a blue-collar Reagan. Remember, they hated Reagan, too. Oh, my. I just got notified of another shooting. This time it was in Santa Fe, Texas. That's about 30 miles southeast of Houston. I guess since it's in Galveston County, probably 10, 15 miles east of Galveston. According to this report, 8 dead. I'm not sure how many wounded. No word on the shooter yet, other than that he is in custody. Looks like there is some concern about explosives. Huh. That says they have 2 in custody. Okay, my dear friends. I would expect more information to come, and I'll give an update at the end of the show. It is time for your brain massage.
Truth served here, flavored with delectable wit, succulent sagacity, luscious logic, a gourmet meal for the mind.
Yes, indeed. The U.S. has made it official. Our embassy has been opened in Jerusalem. Way ahead of schedule, by the way. I think when this first came up, there was talk of 5 years. The target date was moved to 2019. But finally, well, it just got done. What is significant about America making something official that it's talked about doing for decades? And, you know, what's the backstory here? And finally, what are the prophetic implications of this? Well, let's take a look. In ancient history, a people called the Jebusites, descendants of Noah's son Ham, occupied that city. They were a tribe descended from his son Canaan, that is from Haman's son Canaan. Later, in Abraham's day, a famous king named Melchizedek, and that means king of righteousness, was called a priest of the Most High God, ruled in that city that was then called Salem, Genesis 14. God promised to turn the land over to Abraham's seed, and he had Abraham meet the leader of the key city of that land of Canaan. And significantly, Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, Genesis 14, Hebrews 7. The transfer of title from the people of Canaan, the Jebusites specifically, to the people of Abraham took place after the Exodus. However, the Jebusites continued to control Jerusalem. The people were then called Jebusi, see Joshua 18:29, and the city was called Jebus, and that's in Judges 19:10-11. This last stronghold, or outpost, if you will, of Canaanite footing in what God decreed was to be land deeded over, divinely deeded over to Israel, was not occupied by Israel until David became king, 2 Samuel 5, 6 and 8. It was then established as the capital of Israel, or Zion, and that was about 1000 BC, or something like 3000 years ago. And now this continued until the nation was split in two, 10 tribes under Jeroboam called Israel, and then 2 remaining tribes under the house of David called Judah. As Judah and Benjamin. And so Samaria became the capital of Israel, and Jerusalem became the capital of Judah, from which comes the word Jew. Following this? Okay. Israel was scattered in about 721 BC because of her sins, and Samaria fell to the power of the Assyrians. Jerusalem, on the other hand, remained the capital of Judah until God turned them over to Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon for chastisement for their sin. But even then, he did not remove their divine title to that land or to that city. In fact, Jeremiah told them that if they would submit to their chastisement, which was to endure for 70 years under Babylon, they would be allowed to remain in their land and under their own kings. They rebelled. And for that reason, God sent Nebuchadnezzar down on them, who destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed their temple, and then took them into captivity. Nevertheless, the promise from God remained that he would revisit them, or he would visit them in 70 years. And the point is this, that he did not withdraw. He did not cancel their claim upon Jerusalem as their capital. And as God promised, they were restored to their land after 70 years. Now, it took a while for them to get going again, but finally they reoccupied Jerusalem. And in the days of Jesus, they were in their land with their temple. temple. Because they rejected Jesus as their Messiah, Jesus prophesied that they would remain under the power of the Gentiles. Jerusalem, he said, would be trodden under the feet of the Gentiles, and that they would be scattered. And that's all in Luke 21. And yet God's promise, and that all happened, by the way, AD 70, and yet God's promises remained in force. There's nothing in any of this that says that God removed title of the land or of Jerusalem from his people. The prophets predicted that Israel would be mysteriously regathered to her land and being called from every nation on earth where they were scattered. And if you read some of the stories of some of these Jews that during that time experienced this strange impulse and moving to go back to Jerusalem or go back to Israel, it's very, very interesting. But the prophets said it would be limited at first, that they would share the land with the Gentiles. The prophecy began to be fulfilled early on, but by May of 1948, finally, Israel was reestablished in her land. But Jerusalem was split between the newly formed state of Israel and the Palestinians. The surrounding Arab nations, as you know, attacked Israel in 1967. And that was the famous Six Days War. If you have never read about that, you were born later, you need to go read about the Six Days War. It is a miracle. Israel, at the end of that war, reunited Jerusalem under its control. Well, at that time, the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, said, quote, "This morning, the Israel Defense Forces liberated Jerusalem. We have united Jerusalem, the divided capital of Israel. We have returned to the holiest of our holy places, never to depart from it again. To our Arab neighbors, we extend also at this hour, with added emphasis at this hour, our hand in peace. And to our Christian and Muslim fellow citizens, we solemnly promise full religious freedom and rights. We did not come to Jerusalem for the sake of other people's holy places and not to interfere with the adherents of other faiths, but in order to safeguard its entirety and to live there together with others in unity," end quote. Well, that is what the prophecy says. Israel will live in her land side by side with Gentile nations of other faiths. In fact, the prophecy goes on to say Israel will finally come to terms of peace with her Arab neighbors. You know, his brother Ishmael will finally come to terms and live in peace and with great prosperity with his brother Isaac. That's in Isaiah 2, by the way, and Micah 4. And specifically, the prophecy says all faiths will have their place in Jerusalem. The policy is declared clearly in Micah 4, verse 5. Quote, "For all people will walk everyone in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever," end quote. Jerusalem will become a crossroads for all religions, certainly at least the major ones. And during the time of rest with her neighbors, Jerusalem is going to be exalted among all the nations. Connected with this prophecy is the rebuilding of Babylon, which will become the center of world commerce and will feed Jerusalem, right, and sustain it. And Rome, by the way, will be involved in this, holding the golden cup of Babylon in her grasp. And there's more, but I'll need to stop there. My point is that from the days of David, 3,000 years ago, Jerusalem has always been acknowledged as the capital of Israel. Presently, however, it will be shared with the Gentiles, who will continue to tread upon it. And that will go on until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And this doesn't happen until Yeshua HaMashiach returns and establishes the kingdom to Israel and all that happens. By the way, many will be thinking during all of these events that the millennium has come, and they're going to go and say this, but according to the prophecies, it will be peace, peace when there is no peace. Underneath, there will constantly be the turbulence of unrest. You see, it'll be a sort of hiatus maintained by mutual motivations to protect mutual interests. During this time, the gospel will be preached throughout, and Jesus said, "Then the end will come." All right, join my prophecy class Sunday mornings at 9:30 a.m. I'm reviewing a prior study of Revelation chapters 1 to 3 as preface to our major study of Daniel, and then we'll come back and study Revelation chapters 4 to 22. And by the time we are done, we will have considered every prophecy passage in the entire Bible related to end time events. If you want to know how you can receive my course texts for this study free and how to receive my crib notes for each session in advance of the classes free, call 805-714-7731. That number again is 805-714-7731, and talk to the lovely Rebecca. She will explain your options and help you get all set up. Meanwhile, terrorist organization Hamas is using the occasion of our embassy opening in Jerusalem to agitate for war. They are sending young people with some Hamas terrorist members to break through the Israeli border and attack Israeli Border Patrol. 60 have been killed so far. Now, some media spins it off as a peaceful Palestinian protest. Yeah. For example, The Nation claims the organizers committed, quote, after much debate, to a number of key guidelines regarding tactics. No arms, no military uniforms, no party flags, just the Palestinian flag. People could try to cross the border fence if they wished, end quote. That was the rules, according to this article. Curious. The writer, Sharif Abdul Quddus, I guess that's how you pronounce it, reports that, quote, the Israeli military shot more than 1,350 Palestinians in Gaza on a single day on May 14. Then he tells us that while at least 60 people were being killed and over 2,700 wounded, White House officials clinked champagne glasses with their Israeli counterparts 50 miles away in Jerusalem to celebrate the transfer of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv. So, which is it? Did Israeli military snipe, by the way, he claims that the sniper did this, snipe out 1,350 innocent Palestinians? Or did the Israeli military kill 60 Palestinians and wound 2,700 more? There's no way these numbers make any sense. And that's partly because, well, it's fake news, my friends. At least that part about 1,350 Palestinians being shot by Israeli snipers and 2,700 being wounded. They want to blow this thing up, make it a bigger deal than it is, but it is. Listen, 60 were killed. And another source was a little more honest and offered a little clarification to where that other article was coming from. The Conversation reports that there was, in fact, an effort to organize a peaceful protest, but that Hamas duly took the opportunity to stake its claim on the protest, giving its workers time off to join the largest demonstrations on May 14 and 15. Young men affiliated with Hamas set tires alight, threw stones and Molotov cocktails, and tried to breach the fence. These actions, combined with Hamas' specific involvement, gave Israel justification for the use of force, end quote. Well, what is Israel to do? I'm looking at a video here of some young Palestinians charging across the border, and one of them's waving a machete, and he's screaming, "Oh Jews, we have come to slaughter you." All right? This is what, as Bibi said, they're trying to protect their citizens from. Hamas, you know, governs the Palestinian side of Gaza, and he mocked Western efforts to call the Palestinian protests peaceful. He said to call the Palestinian actions on the border of Israel peaceful is a clear deception. He said this is not peaceful resistance, and that's certainly telling the truth. I must say that's what the evidence supports. Whatever effort there has been on the part of some Palestinians to approach this problem peaceably, until their radical counterparts are brought under control, those efforts are going to be vain and only result in more bloodshed. Did you know that way back in 1967, really from 48 to 67, and leading up to the Six Days War, Israel made a pact with Jordan promising they would not attack Jerusalem so long as Jordan maintained peace at their border. They accepted the division of Jerusalem. And that stayed in place from 48 to 67. Well, then the Arab nations decided to push Israel off the map, right? And they launched their war, attacking Israel at their border with Jordan. When the dust settled, Israel had responded and reunited Jerusalem under Israeli control. Now, if you've ever really looked closely at the history of this mess, it's consistently Israel is for peace, but the haters of the Jews want only war. It is exactly like what David said 3,000 years ago. The king of Israel who founded Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Psalm 120 verses 6 and 7, he said, "My soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war." There are some very exciting days ahead for Jerusalem and for the entire Middle East, according to the biblical prophecies. But the transition of the Middle East will not be without much strife and travail. Join me in praying for the peace of Jerusalem. Hold on to the break. I'll be right back. Folks, I've gone a bit long in this segment. We're going to skip the break and just roll right along.
Stand by. The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your
mind. Hello, welcome back. I'm Dr. Jerry Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse and your brain masseur, and Paul Revere's lantern lighter, lighting the lamps in the church belfry arch, singling the enemies on the march, an enemy that would steal from us our liberties. The 1-year anniversary of the Mueller investigation, and all Mueller has to show for it is nothing. Here, let's go quickly through this list of what this writer called pivotal moments in the Mueller investigation, as compiled by the LA Times' Chris Majerian, is how you say it? Are you ready? First, Trump tries to fire Mueller. This is listed under obstruction of justice, by the way. Really? What do you call using a phony dossier prepared as opposition research by the Hillary campaign, passed to the Justice Department where her supporters in that department used it to justify wiretapping her opposition? What do you call weaponizing the government against political opponents? How about perversion of justice? How about flat-out injustice? How about criminal acts of violation of the Constitution? Mueller needs to be fired and then prosecuted for malfeasance. Oh, anyway. Number two. A meeting exposed. Yeah. A Russian lawyer operative baits Trump Jr. with promises of Hillary dirt, and the meeting turns out to be about nothing. And that's what passes for an expose. How about Hillary obstructing justice when she violated a subpoena for her emails, acid-washed the server, and then beat the thing with a hammer? Where does that blip on your obstruction radar? Next major milestone in the Mueller investigation, first guilty plea. A low-level Trump campaign team member gets suckered into biting on a story that Russia hackers had thousands of Hillary emails. Now follow closely, class. This story was planted with Papadopoulos by Obama's FBI plant in the Trump campaign. Young and eager, he was set up by a Hillary supporter to talk about his insider knowledge, getting him drunk and all that, about these emails, and then this fellow reports it to the FBI. See a circle here from FBI to Papadopoulos to FBI, who uses it as justification to pursue Papadopoulos. And they don't get anything tying the Trump campaign to any Russian collusion, but they catch him in a lie about his meeting with Russians who claim to have the Hillary emails, so that's their first conviction. Well, when will we get a conviction for Hillary's lies about? Good night, where do we start? How about everything? Related to Benghazi down through Fast and Furious and her use of a private email account to pass secret government intelligence to foreign powers for payola. Oh, that's right. Her testimony wasn't under oath, so her lies can't be prosecuted. Next, campaign leaders indicted. Manafort and Gates are indicted on charges of money laundering and tax evasion. Manafort has yet to be charged with any campaign-related crimes because there aren't any. Gates is unrelated to Trump, and his crimes had nothing to do with the election. In other words, this has nothing to do with Mueller's investigation. Next, Cohen investigated. Yeah, and anyone else Mueller can think of in his effort to get at Trump. They discover. You know, actually they were tipped off to this and so couldn't use it, but based on the tip went searching for evidence they could use to pursue it, and they discover a payment made to a porn star named Daniels who found a bigger paycheck waiting for her to expose Trump's affair with her and, well, yawn. Can anybody spell Clinton? Or how about Kennedy in Maryland? Or. And these sorts of things mean nothing to liberals when it's their boys in power, but because they know it does concern the demographic supporting Trump, they think we're stupid. We know the game you're playing here, you phony pack of liars, and you have set the rules. So guess what? I don't care about something this president did that was, what, 10 or 20 years ago. Until you indict Hillary for her crimes, you can forget about me being concerned about your effort to trip up Trump on something. You know, listen, he will answer to God for that kind of thing, but you, my friend, I pray soon, I'm talking about Mueller now and that crowd, you will soon answer to the American people for what you're doing. Next in the list of Mueller's great accomplishments with the multiple millions of dollars that he has wasted on this witch hunt. Are you ready? Here it is. Another guilty plea. They hammered, cajoled, threatened, and beat him down, nearly bankrupted him into submission, and finally he agreed to a deal that would involve him saying he lied because that's what they needed, when in fact he did not. A lie is a statement intended to deceive. He made an inadvertent misstatement, and that was not a lie. Those interviewing Lynch said, in their opinion, he did not lie. So what about using the power of government to berate and beat somebody into submission so you can play your little political games, deploying unlimited resources against a private citizen, helpless to defend himself, and then steamroll him into submission or be destroyed? What about that? So Chris, writer of the LA Times, in his attempt to assemble what he desires will be an impressive array of Mueller's accomplishments, milestones in his investigation during his full year's effort to find something, anything. Actually, they know there's nothing to find. It's a delaying tactic, my friend, hoping they can hold Trump at bay long enough to work up a sea change in Congress so they can block him at the November election, and all of this to stop him from discovering and revealing the truth about the Obama administration and the use of the Department of Justice to cover up his and Hillary's high crimes and misdemeanors and outright treason against the United States in the matter of Benghazi, in the matter of the Iran deal, and in the matter of meddling with the election. My friend, the interference into the election was going on in the Hillary campaign when they set it up against Bernie, for one thing, and they did this against Trump with the full knowledge and support of the president at that time, Obama. It was a conspiracy to overturn the constitutional process for the transfer of power in this country. It's treason, nothing less. But to pad the list, Chris adds, Mueller defended. What does that have to do with it? How is that a milestone? Then Republicans target investigation. Here's unbiased journalism at its worst. Chris reports here that Nunes' release of the memo exposing the dossier as fake, as opposition research purchased by the Hillary campaign and used by the Department of Justice to justify violating a citizen's constitutionally protected right to privacy. Well, to be fair, I would have to agree with Chris that this was indeed a pivotal moment in the Mueller investigation. And the question is, now listen, why would he continue this investigation after this was revealed? Or at least under his way too broadly written scope for this investigation, how could he not see this as justification for going full bore into an investigation of Hillary's interference in this election? And her campaign interfering in this election. Don't you see this? Understand, my friend, this man is searching under every rock for some way to connect Trump's campaign to Russian collusion. But the focus is supposed to not be on Trump particularly, right? Never. Remember, Comey tells him, you're not an investigation. The focus legally justifying this was Russian collusion, right? Okay. You want some Russian collusion? How about the Hillary campaign buys a dossier fabricated from Russian informers, feeds it to the FBI where Obama's operatives use it to justify attacking her political opponent with this, gaining access to wiretapping his campaign headquarters, and he did not see this as Russian collusion or as a campaign interfering in an election? Nothing is more obvious than that. This investigation has nothing to do with Russian collusion or anything that remotely resembles justice. It has everything to do with political harassment of Trump as much as possible in hopes they can get him out and shut him up. The next thing on this list of pivotal points in the Mueller investigation, Mueller indicts Russians. 13 to be exact, and what did they do? Well, they deserve to be indicted, for sure. But it turns out they fiddled around buying FB ads and Twitter activity and so on, and hacked this or that social media outlet to put out stories supporting Trump, but mostly supporting Hillary. And the end game for these characters was exactly what our MSM and Never Trumpers have handed to them on a silver platter. They were trying to create chaos in the American government, and I'm sure they must be very satisfied with themselves for a job well done. But no connection to Trump, his campaign. Next, another guilty plea. Unrelated to Trump or to Russian collusion or to the election. Are you hearing me? Totally unrelated. Caught another guy that they were pursuing in hopes to get Trump, who ended up tripping himself up with a lie to cover himself from being implicated in the Manafort investigation. Now, I dare say no one listening to me right now could possibly be prepared for this sort of thing if the government came after you this way. I mean, with unlimited resources, all the time they need to go about harassing you, pursuing you, aggressively interrogating you, threatening you, and yes, even come up with something someone else close to you might have done that they can use to get at you. That's what's going on with this Mueller investigation. That's what they're doing with their office. That's how they're using their power. And only you can stop them, America. This November, wipe them out. Put God-fearing conservatives in a supermajority in both the House and the Senate. Let's get this done. Next, Gates flips. Right. Well, Gates is totally unrelated to Mueller's original investigation. And I'm running out of time for this, but it goes on and on. Democrats fire back. A big deal. They released their memo. It fizzled. The Trump interview negotiations. Oh, this is rich. Trump's lawyers are doing due diligence and preparing to counsel their client if he should decide to accept an interview with Mueller. So they draft a set of questions they think Trump might be asked to prepare to answer them. Who doesn't do that? This gets leaked to the press. That's interesting. Of course it does, right? And the press makes a big issue out of one of the questions. What did you mean when you told Russian diplomats on May 2017 that firing Comey had taken the pressure off? Huh? These people are devious and wicked. Take a cue from the Clinton playbook, Trump, just say, I don't recall. Worked for her. Listen, it's one of those types of questions lawyers sometimes use to plant suspicion with a jury. And in this case, that jury would be the American people. With no expectation of getting any kind of response that would prove anything, the whole point of it is to plant suspicion. That's it. I'm telling you, we're dealing with snakes here. And then Cohen raided. Good night. I spoke to that when it happened. That just gets me stirred up, and then I might really get upset. Okay, Manafort connections. Great. This guy adds the fact that Mueller pursues someone on the basis of past dealings without any reasonable basis for suspecting those past dealings were at play. Hey, you know, hey, this guy knew a Russian, so, you know, could be back channel there. This is a fishing expedition. They have nothing. Democrats sue the Trump campaign. Well, now there's a shocker. Cohen's payments exposed. I addressed that earlier in an earlier show. You know what? as Porky would say. And that's all, folks. The left weaponizing the Department of Justice, turning government into a political weapon. The communist playbook, man. This could be the lowest form of treason that we've seen. A betrayal of one of the founding principles, core principles of our republic. Mueller, Comey, Rosenstein, Obama, Hillary et al., all co-conspirators in this treasonous behavior. What is Sessions doing about all this? I mean, it's like, who is John Galt? Only I might ask, when will Sessions go Galt? When will he finally step in and do something about this renegade Justice Department? You know, was Sessions also a plant in the Trump campaign? Okay, I need to conclude the show. I wanted to follow up on something I introduced last week. Trump is Reagan without the tuxedo, you know? Trump is the blue-collar Reagan. I'm not going to have time to lay out my comparisons. They're very interesting. I'll save it for another show. Maybe I'll do this on a brain massage short video. But I will say this. Remember, they hated Reagan too. I thought we would have more information about the Santa Fe, Texas shooting. Let's see what we've got. Sadly, it's 10 confirmed dead. The shooter has been identified, 17-year-old Dimitrios Pagortsis. He didn't use an AR. He used a shotgun and a 38 revolver, which were both legally owned by his father. Apparently, he had an accomplice, but this is not yet confirmed. Here's something that suggests there's more to this than some rogue kid that suddenly went off the rails. They did find explosives on the school campus and planted elsewhere, by the way. So it's a developing story, and you know how that goes. More information will come out about this kid, what his motivations were, and what's going on as we proceed. A school resource person with a gun stopped it, by the way. Probably saved a lot of lives. I'm glad someone was there to confront this monster and stop him. After Cruz at Parkland, Nicholas Cruz, the White House had a panel, remember, and suggestions were offered. One idea was police departments with satellite offices on school campuses. I think that's a good idea. Another was to arm teachers and to have armed guards on the campus. Did you know that one of the objections to having armed guards on campus was, listen to this, what if a mob of kids attack the officer and take his gun? Is that what our schools have come to? What are these schools becoming? Prisons? Is there really a legitimate concern that kids are going to mob a police officer on their campus and take his gun and start shooting the other kids? Really? You know, there's one thing particularly interesting about the Santa Fe High School shooting, and that is that this school was at the center of the prayer lawsuit back in, I think that was in 2000. But the school was sued by some God-hating, America as founded, despising meddlers because of the school's practice of saying a prayer with the students in assembly before a ball game. The courts decided this was a violation of the so-called separation of church and state. So they succeeded at booting prayer out of this school, too. That's something to think about. Well, I do need to close, but here's a Texan who heard about the shooting. He grabbed his flag and his gun, and he shows up at the school with an American flag on his shoulder and his gun on his belt. Wow. Well, that sure tweaked the libbers there. One libber practically freaked out. I mean, it's interesting. He kept saying, what we need is prayer. What we need is prayer. And then pointing to the patriot who walked away, said, not that. All right. Interesting. Now, I'm not sure if the guy was a plant, you know, I don't know if he was for real. Really, I watched it. The fact is, grabbing the flag and wearing his pistol and incongruently spouting, make America great, it looked a little badly, it looked badly staged to me, quite frankly. But this is Texas, baby. And it is an open carry state. Frustration is growing. It's rising. Something's going to break. Parents are going to demand something get done to protect their kids. Why didn't the teacher in that classroom have the means necessary to protect those children under her watch or his watch? Maybe we'll need an adult with firearms proficiency sitting in every hallway in every school and shifts watching out for our kids. But do something. God bless you. God bless America. And I'll see you in church.
Right here, Saturdays 12 noon and Sundays 7 a.m.